You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. In a vote earlier this week, Republicans in the U.S. Senate blocked an emergency spending bill from Democrats from going forward. That bill included about $50 billion in aid for Ukraine as it continues to fight back the Russian military, as well as about $14 billion in support for Israel's fight against Hamas. This comes as world leaders, including President Joe Biden and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, have been putting more pressure on Israel to protect Palestinian civilians in Gaza. Some Democrats in Congress say they could be doing more. Hamas's attack on October 7th killed at least 1,200 Israelis, and over 100 are still being reported as held hostage. Since then, more than 16,000 Palestinian civilians in Gaza have been killed by Israeli military forces, and more than three-quarters of the population displaced. That includes 12,000 killed in the last week after the end of a temporary pause in fighting. Those numbers, according to Gaza health officials, as reported by NPR. Central Time host Rob Ferret talked about all of this with Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson and Wisconsin Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan, who represents the state's 2nd District, earlier this week. We'll hear the conversation with Senator Johnson first. Rob talked with him on Wednesday before a procedural vote on that aid bill, which Johnson would vote against. Here's a listen.
Well, as I'm talking to you, you and your colleagues in the Senate are considering this spending bill proposed by Democrats. A lot in it, support for Ukraine, some support for Israel, provisions related to the southern border with Mexico. Especially, we'll be talking about Israel mostly. Can you talk about your thoughts on this? Should the Israeli funding be separate from this bill? How does it all roll together?
Well, I've certainly supported what House Republicans did in separating out the Israeli support and paying for it. And so they rose to the occasion very early on, passed about a $14.5 billion package for Israel and paid for it by reducing the number of IRS agents that would be harassing middle-income taxpayers. So I supported that measure. Senator Schumer, of course, hasn't taken that up, and they want to combine, you know, all the support for all these issues together. That's unfortunately one of the ways of Washington, where you take one funding stream or one funding measure that has almost unanimous support and tie it onto something that's more controversial. And that's what Senator Schumer is trying to do right now.
Well, Senator Schumer, I think, would accuse Senate Republicans of trying to tie border security measures to what could otherwise be cleaner international security funding bills. Make the case for attaching what you're looking for at the border to this Israel and Ukraine funding.
Well, first of all, it was President Biden that requested something like $14 billion for border security. But the problem with that is it's really not border security. What he would use the money for is, you know, basically more efficiently and effectively and quickly processing, dispersing more illegal migrants into this country. So the case to be made for what Republicans are trying to do right now is the Biden and Democrat open border policy is a clear and present danger to America. You have Hamas calling for days of rage. You have the FBI director saying that we are at a heightened threat level, that there's you know, we're at very high risk level from foreign terrorist organizations. We know how they can come into this country. Approximately 6 million people have migrated into this country and either been processed or, you know, encountered, processed, and dispersed, or about 1.7 million of that number have been what we call known gotaways. I refer to them as detected gotaways because we don't know who these people are. We have no idea where they are. So this represents an enormous national security threat. It ought to be our top priority when it comes to national security and defense spending. But this administration would rather secure Ukraine's border. We're just thinking, you know, whether you support Ukraine funding or not, our major emphasis ought to be securing our own border, and that's what Republicans are insisting on.
Do you support Ukraine funding?
I have mixed feelings about it. I have a great deal of sympathy for the Ukrainian people. Unfortunately, the way this war has been waged, it's not been waged successfully. I think we probably could have deterred Putin from ever invading Ukraine. I think there's a point in time early in the war when Putin had not overrun Ukraine. He was kind of back on his heels that I supported $40 billion of funding at that point in time to replenish our own stockpile. But that didn't change Putin's mind. Now we have a 22-month-long grinding, bloody stalemate. The only way this war ends is through a negotiated settlement. Ukraine can't win this war. Russia won't lose it. They have nuclear weapons. Losing the war is existential to Putin. They can wait it out. Ukraine can't start bombing Moscow to reduce the support for the war in Russia. So this has to end in a negotiated settlement. And every day that goes by, more Ukrainians, civilians and soldiers die. More Russian conscripts die. I take no joy in that. More of Ukraine gets destroyed. So I don't think it's been a bad thing that Zelensky understands that he doesn't have an open checkbook for an endless war. Personally, I think what we should have done, rather than encourage a summer offensive, which obviously failed, we should have started moving Ukraine toward a defensive posture, more of a guerrilla war against an invading occupying force, as opposed to, you know, offensive and counteroffensives. It's been a very poor strategy. And in our secure briefing yesterday with Secretary Austin and Blinken, I mean, I asked, I think, what was the $64,000 question, how does this end? You know, how do we end this war? Because this war needs to end. And they didn't have a very satisfying answer.
Turning to Gaza now, there's a dire humanitarian situation there. Millions displaced, over 15,000 killed by what seem to be accepted estimates. As the U.S. continues to provide military aid to Israel, do you think it's appropriate to call on the Israeli government and military to minimize harm to Palestinian civilians?
Well, I wish Hamas would have minimized harm and not and done no harm to the 12 to 1,400 Israelis that they brutally slaughtered in the most horrific way. Yeah, I try and point out that on a percentage of population, 1,400 Israelis represents about 50,000 Americans. You can imagine what the American public would be demanding of its government in terms of retribution, but primarily defensive actions to make sure it never happened again. And so there's no moral equivalency here. It's the citizens of Gaza that by and large voted in Hamas. I'm not saying every one of them supports Hamas, but a majority of them did. They've allowed Hamas to rule brutally, and then it's Hamas that are the terrorists here, not Israel. So I think Israel has every right to defend itself. War is horrific, which is why Israel basically created a multi-year ceasefire with Hamas. It's Hamas that broke that ceasefire in the most horrific and brutal way.
And Hamas, of course, has a strategy of basically parking itself under and near civilians and infrastructure. I think nobody disagrees or nobody in the American government disagrees. They bear a lot of responsibility here. But that said, even some of the recently released hostages who had been held by Hamas in a meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu said, hey, you're bombing indiscriminately there. You were putting us at risk. Is there a case to be made for allowing more civilian aid into and for targeting more carefully to avoid civilian casualties?
Well, first of all, any aid that flows into Gaza will be controlled by Hamas. If you provide fuel, it'll provide fuel for the war effort. If you provide medicine, it'll be to provide medical care to their fighters. There is no such thing as aid to the Gaza civilians. This is all going to Hamas. So why would we support Hamas when Israel is trying to and righteously and justifiably trying to destroy Hamas, which is what they need to do, and we need to support their efforts in destroying Hamas?
What policy would you like to see the U.S. government take in the weeks to come?
Support Israel and their ability to defend itself and destroy Hamas. Get rid of that terror threat once and for all.
I've seen terrorism experts argue that civilian deaths in Gaza are recruiting tools, not just for Hamas, but for sympathetic organizations in many parts of the world. A ceasefire potentially could avoid that situation, avoid inspiring terror elsewhere. Do you think there's a case for that?
As I said, Israel initiated a ceasefire with Hamas over many, many years. They gave Gaza to the Palestinians. Palestinians then elected Hamas. And there's been a ceasefire. Israel hasn't gone on the offense. It's been rockets, coming in from Gaza, year after year, that every now and again Israel has to respond to, but it's always Hamas. It's always the Palestinians that are breaking that truce. So what's the ceasefire going to do here other than give Hamas more breathing room, allow them to survive, to strike another day. No, Israel has to be allowed to destroy Hamas once and for all. They have to rid themselves of this threat. That's what Americans would certainly demand of our government had 50,000 of our citizens been brutally slaughtered in the manner that Hamas slaughtered Israeli citizens.
As we wrap up, what is your hope for, assuming Israel could destroy Hamas effectively in Gaza, what then is your hope for the future of Israel and Palestinians?
Well, one example was the Syrians in the Golan Heights. And there was, a huge international outcry when Israel imposed Israeli law on those Syrians. I think those Syrians feel themselves unbelievably lucky to be living under the legal framework and the protection of Israel right now. I personally, they've been pursuing a two-state solution for how many decades now? That was an attempt with giving Palestinians Gaza. It didn't work. I think at some point in time, Israel's just going to have to basically dictate and have its jurisdiction over these lands if they ever expect to have peace.
Effectively annexing Gaza, are you saying?
They're going to have to administer them, and they're going to have to enforce laws, and they're going to have to, you know, weed out terrorists. And Palestinians don't like it. They ought to be open to go to other Arab states that hopefully would accept them. That's, you know, there's been a real failure on the part of Arab states to take people from Palestine that simply cannot apparently live with Israel or Jews as their next door neighbors.
Senator Johnson, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Have a good day. Have a Merry Christmas.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Central Time host Rob Ferret talking with Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson on Wednesday this week about the war in Gaza and financial support for Ukraine, Israel, and issues concerning the southern border with Mexico. Coming up, we'll hear Rob's interview with Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan on the same topics. That's next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with members from Wisconsin's congressional delegation about the war in Gaza and U.S. support for Israel and Palestinians. We just heard Rob's interview with Senator Ron Johnson from earlier this week. Now we'll listen to Rob speaking with Wisconsin Democrat Mark Pocan from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. They talked yesterday.
A Democratic bill failed in the Senate yesterday. It would have provided billions of dollars in security assistance to Ukraine, as well as Israel and humanitarian relief in Gaza. Had some security measures on the southern border. Didn't satisfy Republicans. They were holding out for more on the border. What are your thoughts on that bill and what you'd like to see happen when it comes to spending, especially when it comes to Israel and Gaza?
Well, it appears the Republicans are trying to hold hostage the additional support to Ukraine currently over extra border protections. I don't think Russia cares what we're doing at our southern border as we're trying to provide the support for Ukraine to continue to be able to defend itself against an invading country. We would hope that people would not put those kind of lines in the sand. If we don't have support to Ukraine by the end of the year, it could be really devastating to Ukraine's efforts. And, you know, I think that this is some gamesmanship that's pretty dangerous, and I hope that that will end.
The argument from Republicans, including Senator Ron Johnson, is that our southern border is a direct security issue right on our border. Ukraine, big an issue as it might be further away. Does it make sense to deal with a national security issue close to home at the same time as we're looking at Ukraine and Israel?
Well, there actually is border money in the bill. Ron Johnson would be required to read the bill in order to understand that. But to try to hold it hostage for that is really a problem, because I guarantee if you gave them what they want there, they're just going to ask for something else. This is how they've operated all year. They're, as you know, this is the least productive Congress, I believe, since the Depression. This is exactly why. So this is one area I just wish we'd quit playing games, quit trying to be too clever by half, quit trying to gain, followers on social media, and just do what's important to do. And right now, that would be supporting especially the people in Ukraine.
As we've mentioned on the show, there's a dire humanitarian situation in Gaza now. Millions displaced, over 15,000 killed. As the U.S. provides military aid to Israel, you've made calls on Israel to minimize harm to Palestinian civilians. Do you think that Congress or other elements of the U.S. government should be doing more to pressure Israel to listen to those calls to protect Palestinian civilians?
Honestly, I think the White House has got the most influence here, and they've been saying the same thing, quite honestly, is they're saying be as surgical as possible in going after Hamas. Clearly, you know, 16,000 people dead, including 6,000 plus children, it is not surgical. You know, kids are not Hamas fighters, clearly. And I think that still is a valid concern. You know, you can't just take out 100 people in order to get one Hamas fighter. You can do it in a far better way, especially when Israel has some of the best intelligence allegedly on the planet. So we would like them to behave differently. I think some of this has been collective punishment, kind of anger at the Palestinian people in Gaza over Hamas. But I think it's been misdirected. And it also could bring in other countries like Iran, or could bring in Hezbollah into this conflict. That would be much more deadly, both for people in Israel and Palestine. So I think the president and those of us who've called for restraint, it's a smart call.
A call for restraint is one thing. Do you think there should be strings attached to U.S. military aid to Israel with lines? If you do X with the weapons we're providing, we will stop the flow of them?
I think it's going to see what the Senate sends to us. So they're going to be sending that. I think, you know, whenever we give U.S. aid, it's fine to have restrictions on how it can be used. I mean, we don't want it used indiscriminately if it's going to be weaponry. And I think that's a fair assessment to have if that's how the Senate decides to proceed.
Some of your colleagues have made a direct call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The argument from Israel and supporters is a ceasefire benefits Hamas first and foremost, would allow them time to regroup. What are your thoughts on calls for a ceasefire?
You know, I've said all along, Israel has every right to go after Hamas for what happened October 7th. What they're doing is not just going after Hamas. I really do believe it's collective punishment of Palestinians, and that is going too far. 6,000 dead kids is going too far. So, you know, during the period we had a ceasefire, I think that proved we could have something in place. But, you know, Hamas has to release hostages. Hamas has to pay a price for what it did. And I think we can have a balance that does both. Right now, I do feel that the power imbalance is really taking advantage and killing too many innocent civilians in Gaza.
Talking to Representative Mark Pocan about the latest on U.S. policy in Gaza. There have been concerns now in domestic politics in the U.S. that the issues surrounding the war in Gaza and Democratic responses to it could impact them on Election Day and re-election chances in Congress, maybe even in the race for the White House. Are you concerned about that?
Well, I think every issue, you know, impacts how people look at the election. Clearly, younger people in particular are having a real concern about the number of deaths. In fact, I shouldn't even say to younger people. I think we keep saying that because we see that most active in the streets. I can tell you from constituents, 2,800 people in my district, which is a huge number on any issue, have reached out to us asking for a ceasefire. I mean, I think people are watching this. They do see the imbalance of power, and they are concerned when kids in particular are killed during a conflict. So as awful as it was for the 29 kids that were killed on October 7th in Israel, the 6,000 kids in Gaza are also of concern, and we're certainly hearing it from our constituents.
Supposing some kind of ceasefire can be reached and at least the immediate conflict slowed down, what are your hopes for a resolution in the next year or two?
You know, honestly, the if there is a silver lining to everything that's happened, and I know it sometimes seems hard to, I've heard more talk about a two-state solution than I have in the last decade, and that's good because I think we do need to work towards, that's been the longstanding U.S. position, a land for both Israelis and a land for Palestinians. And we've watched that slipping away, I think, in the last decade. It's certainly been a reinvigorated conversation, and that would be positive if that could come out of this.
As we wrap up, are there things you'd like to hear and see from the White House that you haven't so far since October 7th?
You know, I think the White House doesn't wear their foreign policy generally on their sleeve. They have a lot of very private conversations, and that's how Joe Biden operates. And, you know, when he starts raising it a little more in public, like we've heard him say about bombing hospitals and being more surgical and how they're going after Hamas, I think it's because he's trying to make sure that those things can happen, and he's not feeling like he's been able to accomplish it privately in conversations. But I do think the White House is doing the most they can to try to minimize any deaths of either Israelis or Palestinians in trying to hopefully have a positive influence. You know, I do think it's good that we have a special envoy now there. And I think anything we can do to help bring not only peace, but a two-state solution is going to be in the best interest of the United States.
Representative Pocan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Of course. Thank you.
That was Central Time host Rob Ferret speaking with Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan, a Democrat from the 2nd Congressional District, yesterday. Earlier, we heard Rob's interview from Wednesday with Senator Ron Johnson. We talked with the two lawmakers about aid priorities for Ukraine and Israel and the partisan disagreements about linking that with border security, as well as influencing Israel to minimize attacks on Palestinian civilians in Gaza and how each elected official could see a resolution to the conflict. Coming up Monday on Central Time, some college football coaches are getting paid millions of dollars to not coach. We'll talk about contract buyouts and where all the money in college football programs is coming from. Also, a Mequon school board member was charged with violating the state law banning selfies at the ballot box. That suit was dismissed by a judge. We'll explore what the law says about showing off how we vote. Plus, Spotify is out with its yearly Wrapped feature. A guest says it's time to remember how little income Spotify provides for recording artists. That and more coming up here on Central Time this Monday. Coming up after the news, this year's National Spelling Bee champion joins us to talk about how he trained to become a better speller and why English words can be so tricky to spell. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. First, do you know what a cocoa mat is? What about Schistoricus or an Egeris? If you don't, that's all right. They're a mat made from coconuts, a spinal disorder, and a species of goat. But can you spell them? Our next guest can. In fact, he spelled all of these stumpers and more correctly and won the National Spelling Bee. We've got a champion speller here to share his approach to mastering even the trickiest words. We want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. Are you a good speller? Have you ever been in a spelling bee? How did you prepare? Are there words that you can just never remember how to spell? And what questions do you have about getting better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Dev Shah is the winner of the 2023 Scripps National Spelling Bee. He recently wrote a piece in the Washington Post called "I Won the National Spelling Bee. This is what it takes to master spelling." Dev, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, a big congratulations on your win in the summer. What did it feel like to be up there on stage and hear the judges tell you that you spelled that final word correctly?
Yeah, thank you so much. I never really imagined it. Like, as I said, I lost dozens of bees, but it was kind of like a dream come true, and it was really surreal.
And what do you think the difference was this time around that got you to the finals?
I think I really focused on being able to guess a word correctly, and not even, I kind of made a mistake. It's not really guessing, it's kind of predicting. And I really just focused on my battles and picked my battles strategically because there are 11 million competitors, right? And only one can win. So at the end of the day, you have to focus on your strengths.
And you wrote in your Washington Peace post that, you know, to become a good speller and to get ready for a B like this, you shouldn't be trying to memorize all the words. Why not?
People who pick out the words, they're expert linguists, and they pick words that you can trick with other words and you can confuse with other words and other simple words. And they pick really obscure words so that you actually have to understand language to really be able to guess it or predict it. And you should prepare for every situation and every scenario, because the spelling bee is really volatile and unpredictable.
Yeah, and I think you wrote that there's something like half a million words that could be in play. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. And they come from a wide variety of languages, and they have a wide variety of definitions. So you have to be prepared for any situation.
Yeah. From what I understand, English is kind of made up of a layer of different languages that have influenced it at one time or another and found their spellings and pronunciations into the language. Is that part of what makes it so difficult and unpredictable?
Yeah, like, for instance, there are words that come from Maori, a language in New Zealand. There are words that come from Native American languages. There are words that come from Dutch, German. So you have to really pin down the phonetic patterns in each of these languages and be able to apply them and piece out a word.
And you wrote that it really helps to know the how and the why of a word when you hear it. Why is that important?
So, especially when you're on stage, you may know 50,000 words, but knowing the how and why means you can apply those patterns and phonics to other words. So I think the application part matters much more than the memorization part.
We're talking with Deb Shah right now, winner of the 2023 Scripps National Spelling Bee. He's with us here to talk about his experience and how to get better at spelling. And Deb, I want to hone in on one of the words that you spelled in the National Bee, periosi. How would you approach predicting that spelling if you didn't already know how to spell it?
Okay, so with periesi, so that comes from two Greek parts. The first part is peri, meaning around, like perimeter. And the second part comes from oikos, meaning house, like ecosystem or ecosphere. So you would kind of just piece it out and from those two parts. And the OE part is what really trips up most spellers. So I got that part. Most of these words have a tricky spot.
Yeah, I'm glad that I wasn't the one to give you the pronunciation for that one, Deb. Thanks for correcting me. And so how would you spell that?
So first it's perimeter, right? So P-E-R-I and then oikos, O-E-C-I.
Nice. And so when you are asking the judges for that extra information, specifically the definition, what are you looking for when they give you the answer?
So what I'm looking for is words that can give me the clues to these roots. So for instance, in samophile, right, in the definition, it's things or animals that live in sandy soils. And keywords are basically words that give away the roots. So sandy is a keyword. And I thought of roots that meant sand. And instantly I thought of samos. And that's what gave the rest of the spelling.
Yeah, and samophile was your winning word this year in the B. And the part that seems the trickiest to me in there is that double M in the middle of samophile. How did you figure out that there was two M's?
Yeah, so the PS and the two M's, those were the tricky spots in that word. And I just thought of other words with samo because like, right, sandy soils. I knew other words that started with SAMO, and right, that's the application part, being able to apply other roots to new words that you haven't heard of.
Interesting. And another thing that I hear spellers asking the judges a lot is to use a word in a sentence. Why is that helpful?
Honestly, that like really helps in the local bees, in the school or regional bee. I personally never ask those. I just like ask them as like a way to get reassurance and calm down a little because nerves are the biggest part, really, managing emotions.
Sure, to buy yourself a little bit of time up there.
To be fair, they don't really pause the timer. They just keep going.
Gotcha.
So you have to be conservative.
And one of your words also in the B this year, I believe in the finals of the National B was, or the first round, I should say, was something that comes from French, ardoise or ardois. That's, again, a different language coming into English and being used in the B. What were your thoughts when that word was posed to you?
Well, it certainly isn't like the first time it's happened. The bee does prefer a lot of French, Dutch, German, practically every language. So when I heard Ardoise, I was prepared. And I think what really changed this year was preparing for each situation. And I knew that they were very heavy on French, so I prepared French words as well.
And what is your you know, I think back to when I learned spelling, and it was flashcards and maybe the occasional computer game with spelling, and I can't really think of anything else. So I'm curious, Deb, what's your training routine like? How do you study up?
So the majority of what it would be is advanced searching, and that's basically like categorizing words in languages and word combinations. So for instance, in SAMAfile, the first two letters is PS, right? So I would do a search for words that start with PS, and then I'd go through that list and then analyze like stems and exceptions, because there's never really an always in spelling. There's always going to be a word that breaks the rule. And then I'd focus on vocabulary, because vocabulary is a huge part of the competition. You can't get through without mastering vocab. And then I just have someone quiz me, like my father. And I think that helps with managing emotions and that part.
And is there a word, or are there types of words that you find particularly frustrating or difficult?
Yeah, for sure. I would say eponyms. Those are basically words that come from names. And the thing is, you can't really ask for roots when it comes to eponyms, because they're just names. So it's hard to piece them out, and you kind of just have to use phonetic patterns and your intuition.
And Deb, for people out there, whether they're young, old, and they want to become a better speller, what is your kind of take-home tip for them?
My take-home tip is to expose yourself to more words, because at the end of the day with spelling, the biggest strength that you can have is an intuition. You're never really going to know how to spell every word right. But if you can just predict a word with an intuition by exposing yourself to more words through reading, watching movies, stuff like that, I think that's the biggest takeaway.
And Deb, as we wrap up, I understand this was your last year of eligibility for the Spelling Bee. Now that you've won it and had this experience, what are you taking away from it?
What I've taken away from it is to appreciate the journey a little bit more, because the final destination was like winning, right? And that only lasted for a good 20 seconds. So compared to 5 years, I think the journey really mattered a lot more than the whole moment, winning moment.
That is some good advice. Deb, it was really cool to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Deb Shah is the winner of the 2023 Scripps National Spelling Bee. He talked with us about his approach to spelling and how we can all become better spellers. In a minute, we'll talk with a linguist about why English spelling in particular is so tricky. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is English a second language for you? If so, what have you observed about spelling in English? Have you found it more or less difficult than other languages? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about spelling. Spelling in English can be pretty strange. For example, why do we have silent Ks, like in night? Why do head, heart, and theater all have different vowel sounds, even though they're spelled with the same vowels? We're talking about the irregularities of English spelling, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the history of spelling in English and how our language got so strange? What words do you find tough to spell? Have you coached yourself to spell them well in some way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Erica Okrent is a linguist and author of books including Highly Irregular, Why Tough, Through, and Dough Don't Rhyme, and Other Oddities of the English Language. Erica, welcome back to Central Time. Erica, are you there with us?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Hi.
Hey, good to hear from you. Erica, before we get going, I just want to get your thoughts on what Dev had to say earlier. It was really cool to talk to him. What do you think of what he had to say about spelling and the experience of a B champion?
Yeah, well, it was really interesting to hear his technique and how he kind of absorbs some patterns and is able to work with them. Because often you'll hear about English spelling and it seems like there is no pattern. How do you do that? And it is true that there's not a rule. You can't say, here are the 100 rules of English spelling or here are the 1,000 rules of English spelling. You'll never get that. But there are patterns that you can study and absorb as you read and learn languages. And you can't really predict what spelling it's going to be from a list of rules or patterns, but you can back explain. Once you've got the spelling, you can explain it, which most people don't realize because we like to shrug and say, oh, English spelling, you know, it is what it is. What are you going to do?
And is it fair to say that English is trickier than other languages because of all the layers that have formed it?
It is because of the spelling. So every language has irregularities, things you just have to memorize. Every language is difficult in its own way for people who don't know it yet. But English does have a special difficulty when it comes to spelling. And that has to do with the history of the writing system of English and the layers that went into producing the writing system that we have.
One of the changes that English went through was called the Great Vowel Shift. And from what I understand, words like book with double vowels O used to be pronounced boke, or boot mm-hmm. used to be pronounced boat. Why did that change?
Well, yeah, the spelling used to make sense. It was a long O, and it's spelled with two O's. But over time, the vowel system of English shifted, and that happened right as the writing system was developing, and we were coming out of the years of where we didn't really use English as a written language. French was the written language in England for a long time. And when English writing started coming back and the printing press started coming in, different regions of English were pronouncing things in very different ways, and the whole system was shifting. The range of the vowels were different from place to place and from region to region, and the spelling got fixed in a haphazard way from here to there, and whose spelling was being used.
And I think of, you know, reading historical documents, even from the colonial era here in America, and you see a lot of phonetic spelling too. When did phonetic spelling kind of take hold and then go out of style?
Well, the original written English, old English of, you know, the year 800, was very, very regular and phonetic. It wasn't really written down to begin with. And then when Roman priests came in and started writing, using it as a written language, they didn't have all those sounds in Latin, and they had to come up with ways of approximating these strange English sounds. So that gave us things like the GH for this H sound that we had and don't have anymore, but that spelling stayed. And then it stopped being a written language for a long time. And when it came back, there were just many ways of spelling things that were phonetic to the people that were writing here and there in different places, but not for other people who were also using English. So what was once phonetic became kind of random in which one got accepted and used the most.
We're talking with Erica Okrent right now, linguist and author of books, including Highly Irregular. We're talking about the English language and why its spelling can be so tricky. Erica, another thing I wanted to ask about is the silent K. And it sounds like this is a spelling left over from old English. Words like knight and knife used to have the K make an actual sound. And I'm interested in this partly because my own last name, Knetter, still has that K in there. why did those K's stop making their sound.
Well, yes, that was from the period of time when our spelling system was very phonetic and very regular, and we actually pronounced those words with the K sound. Then natural language changes, which happened to every language, changed the sound system, and that initial K dropped out. And, you know, other languages like Spanish has that double L, which isn't pronounced as a double L because it changed. It's that one was sort of a natural change over time. That sound disappeared, but we had already kind of stabilized the spelling of that. So that is a natural change that happens in languages. But English had various other things like the vowel system shift, and also adopting a lot of other words from other languages, and learning to use English again as a written language after this long period of not being a written language, that make it unlike other languages and why they lost letters or lost sounds.
I also want to ask about the example that's right in the title of your book, why tough, through, and dough all make different sounds despite having that O-U-G-H at the end of all of them.
Yeah, that one's a real tricky one, especially for learners of English and for kids learning to write. Like, this makes no sense. What is the rule here? But if you look at, you know, the history, that G-H, that actually stands for something that used to be there, this h sound, that changed over time, either dropped out or changed to an F sound in different regions of England. And the vowels were originally three different vowels that were written three different ways that then overlapped with this new way of trying to write vowels down while we were in the midst of this sound change where different regions did everything differently and landed in this place where it looks like they should all be the same vowel, but they never were. And there's an interesting, the do one, we have the do, and that G-H became an F, and it's still a word in England for a special kind of dessert called duff. Plum duff is a sort of Christmas dessert. And it's the same word, it's do, but for that word, it went the F way. And for the do word, it dropped out, but it's that G-H, that H sound, that's where it came from in both cases. And it went two separate ways, and we've got different spellings.
And Erica, just in our last minute, all of this can make English pretty tough to spell, probably pretty tough to learn for someone coming into it the first time. But does it make it interesting to study?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I love seeing a word and thinking, huh, I wonder where this, why is it spelled this way and pronounced this way? And you can look it up, and the answer is in the history and the layers of this history, where it's not as simple as it seems, because every layer complicated it a bit more. But I love tracking down those things and hunting for the answer for why is this way.
We'll leave it there. Erica, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Erica Okrent is a linguist and the author of books including Highly Irregular, Why Tough, Through, and Dough Don't Rhyme, and Other Oddities of the English Language. She talked to us about why English spelling can be so challenging. Earlier, we talked with Dev Shah, winner of the 2023 Scripps National Spelling Bee. I'm Dean Kinetter. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.